Welcome to the Prison Pod, a podcast for all people experiencing incarceration. The mission of this podcast is to save lives, restore hope, reduce suffering, and recidivism. Many show ideas come directly from the listeners, so please write the host. Prison Pod, Post Office Box 294, Orono, Maine, 04473. Here is your host, Ms. Valerie.
Welcome back again to the Prison Pod. I'm always excited when we have experts in the house. And I'm saying that because right on her website, it says that Cheryl Morris is a corrections expert. And after speaking to her previously, I kind of agree with that. So I'm so excited today that Cheryl is going to be joining us from New York, and we'll be talking about her work, previous life, and now what she's doing. So welcome, Cheryl.
Hi, Valerie. Thank you so much. How are you today?
I'm doing great. And I'm so thankful to have you as a guest because I really feel that you have some real important things to share with us. I'm going to ask you first a little bit about your background and what you've done in your previous life and work. And then we'll jump into what you're doing today and what makes you such a professional at what you're doing.
Okay. So I'll sum it up as quickly as short as I can. I worked for 30 years in the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. I started off as a corrections counselor in a work release facility. And what I did there was assist people who were still under custody, but were being given an opportunity to get a jump start on their release. So they were transferred to a minimum security prison and given an opportunity to go out and find a job. They had to live in the prisons and earn the privileges of being able to gradually stay at home a few nights during the week. They had to work, report to the parole officer, and we helped them with budgeting and things like that. So I did that for a few years. Then I transferred to a medium correctional facility, and I did guidance counseling, but not in the sense of what we know as in the school. We did assessments for the incarcerated individual as far as the program needs, and we made the referrals. In some cases, we actually facilitated some of those programs. And we ran groups with them. I did that for a while. Then I went back to another prison, worked in work release for a while. Then I went into central office substance abuse. And I want to go back and say, out of the 30 years, my career it's a little different. It was split pretty much down the middle as far as working in prisons and working in central office. I've worked in minimum, medium, and maximum security prisons, and I've worked in central office in several capacities as a counselor, as an assistant director for guidance and counseling, and as a director for Ministerial Family and Volunteer Services, where I had statewide oversight of all religious accommodations, family services programs, and volunteer services. So I indirectly supervised those programs, did program development, reviewed and approved contracts with community-based organizations. I served as a liaison with the religious communities out in society. And I worked a lot with the Attorney General's office on litigation, primarily related to religious accommodations and family services. And in that role, although difficult, it was probably my most rewarding position. I was very intimidated when I took it because I didn't know anything about those areas. So it challenged me to learn. And I think I did well. We created programs. Like I said, I was also, during that position, selected to work with the National Institute of Corrections because we had a little crisis as far as being able to provide equal and fair religious accommodations to all the groups. We had 55 different religions that were approved, but we were not knowledgeable of all those religions. So I was tasked to figure out what they were required to be given and make sure they got that in a fair and equitable manner. And in doing that, I ran across the National Institute of Corrections to ask them for some technical assistance in the form of grant money to run some training so that we could educate our staff on areas, on some of those emerging faith groups that we really didn't have a lot of information about. And in doing that, they kind of liked New York's approach, and they created a focus group with different religious directors from around the country. And I was lucky enough to be invited out to their training academy in Aurora, Colorado, a couple of times, where they allowed us to, a group of us to co-develop and co-facilitate some national trainings on religious accommodations. So after doing that job for a number of years, I decided I wanted slower paced for the end of my career at that point. So I went back to the prisons. I worked in two more maximum security prisons before I retired in February of 2022.
So I love the idea that you have worked in so many different areas inside the prisons, but also in administration, because you get a really large worldview of what goes on throughout all of the Department of Corrections. And so now you have officially retired, but you've started a new career. And all this experience leads up to this new career. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So when I retired, I really didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew that I knew corrections and I knew leadership development. I really didn't know how to incorporate corrections in my afterlife or my parole, because I tell people I did a 30-year bid. So I didn't know how to incorporate that, but I did know how to jump in and do some coaching. So I did some online coaching and professional development. And a few months ago, I was actually certified to become a New York State Minority Women Business Enterprise vendor. So that allowed me to apply for government or state contracts and grants. And when I received that certification, I knew that it was going to allow me many more opportunities than I would have as a coach, because I believe there's a huge need, although there are a lot of opportunities, a lot of organizations out there providing reentry services, there's still a huge gap as far as having, in my opinion, quality reentry services to help deal with the recidivism. Because, I mean, I don't have the accurate numbers now, but I do know that the recidivism rate today is not much different than what it was two decades ago. And with all the opportunities out there as far as reentry opportunities, there should be a bigger dent, in my opinion, on recidivism. And in my opinion, based on what I've witnessed when I was working, people are well-intended in wanting to provide these services to assist just as impacted individuals when they're coming home, but I don't know that they're necessarily fully equipped to do that. I think that a lot of what happens is just putting band-aids. You know, we'll offer somebody housing. This group will offer somebody housing. This group will offer somebody mental health services or substance abuse, which are all very much needed because those are like three of the biggest issues that people face when they come home. But I think that organizations could be more impactful if they were collaborating. If you don't have the resources to address this issue holistically, because I don't think it will ever be, a dent will be put in it unless there's a holistic approach. We can't just deal with mental health and forget about housing. We can't or hope that they find a resource out there for their housing. I think that the system as a whole is responsible, because the corrections is responsible for creating a discharge plan for people before they go home. I think that it is very important, and it doesn't happen in New York. I can't say what happens in other states, but I think that the planning needs to take place far earlier than what it does. And it needs to be, again, a holistic approach. What we do is our people will do an assessment. This is what you need. And they'll forward it over to community supervision for so that they can monitor them when they're on the outside. They make referrals as they can, but I think so much more should be done and can be done. I think there should be more thorough assessments. I think that all stakeholders should be brought to the table pre-release, because many of the reentry services people don't have their initial contact with the individual until they're already released. Well, the resources and services should already be in place, in my opinion, before they go home. A lot of people fail at succeeding because they don't always go home with the vital documents that they need, whether it's their birth certificate, their social security card. They have a state ID maybe, but you need all those things already in hand when you walk out of the door so that you can do the job searching, so that, you know, you have the credentials, because you have to be able to have those documents in order to get housing, to get a job, to, you know, have your medical in place, social security if for the people who are going to be on SSI. You know, so you need these documents. And I think that the system is very much lacking, you know, because they put memos of agreements in place with the federal agencies, with Social Security and DMV. But they allow leniency in that when people are screened and they don't have a birth certificate or a Social Security card, they're offered the opportunity to apply. And sometimes the individual says, oh, I have it at home, so I don't want to apply. They may have it at home, but if they've been incarcerated for 15 years, do you know where it is? Probably not. And whoever is at home, do they know where it is? Probably not. Many times our population don't have stable homes. So whoever had those documents have moved how many times during that time of incarceration? So is it lost? I think that the system should insist that people walk out of the door with these vital documents, because it's so important for them to begin to rebuild their life once they're released.
You made a really important mention of reentry, and sometimes it doesn't start soon enough. And I heard Cardell Sims say recently, reentry should start the day that you walk through the doors of the prison. And that is so true, because if we truly look at the purpose of incarceration, which is to protect society, to have them be accountable for what has happened, and that is where they're going to stay until society feels their time has ended there. But the other part of incarceration, in my opinion, is rehabilitation. And that seems to be a piece that was missing for a long time, but seems to be coming into focus, really highlighting now of the things that need to be done while people are inside so that they can come home and the recidivism rates can drop. Because I think the last time I looked here in Maine, they were 72%. You know, and the cost of housing someone in prison here, the last time I looked, was $41,000 a year. And it's been a couple of years since I've even looked at that data. So I can imagine in New York, it's probably double that.
I don't have the numbers now. I don't stay on top of that stuff. But I know at one point we were pretty close to $60,000 per individual at one point. I honestly don't know what it is now.
Now, your work that you're doing now, who are the people that might contact you for assistance or services? And when you get done talking about that, I want you to make sure to say where they can get in touch with you.
Oh, okay. So my primary focus group has become, I didn't start off this way. Initially, I started off saying that I would like to work with attorneys, judges, and advocates. And that was because while I was working, I told you I worked a lot with the Attorney General's office. One thing that I didn't understand but quickly learned was that attorneys and judges know state and federal law. They do not understand corrections policies. And to me, that's, you would think that it's natural, a natural progression, unless you work in that environment. Because in my opinion, corrections policies should mirror state and federal laws. And many times they don't. They are legislatively driven, but they're not in alignment with the laws, which I think would minimize so many problems and barriers on both sides of the fence if they did. So once I understood that, I spent a lot of time interpreting corrections policies for the attorneys prior to the actual, well, during the litigation process. And once they understood it, they were more successful in whatever litigation they were facilitating. But it also helped the agency, and I think population, it rolls down. It's a domino effect, because if what was happening prior to was people were making decisions based on what they knew. Nobody was going out of their way to find out why we were still having this broken process. This is just how we always did it. And that's a very common terminology in corrections, and I hate it. Oh, it's always been done this way. Well, it's not working. So obviously, you need to find something else. So I would encourage them to find a way, or help them find a way, to balance the law and corrections policy. And once I left the agency, I thought that that was still very much needed, and I still believe that. But I see more of a need for the activists who are contacting me. They want help on program development, the reentry services development pieces. So I'm doing a lot of consultation on that, as well as policy reform, prison policy reform. So policy development, because I wrote policies when I worked for the agency. I understand how they're written and why they're written in the manner that they're written. So that's policy development and reentry services program development are the main things that people are asking me for help with. But I have a menu of things that I can gravitate toward, if, depending on what the person's need. As far as how to reach me, I have a website that's it's up, but it's being revised, and it is http://cvm-enterprises.com. And my email is cvm-enterprises.com if someone wanted to reach me that way. I'm also on LinkedIn under Cheryl Morris, but if you type in cvm-enterprises, you should also get me. Those are the three best ways to reach me for anyone who has questions or interested in brainstorming sessions.
Okay. And you kind of just answered the question I was going to ask you next, which was, for those people that are listening inside, how does your experience affect them now with the work that you do? And I assume policy.
Definitely policy. And as well as the program development, because I'm very fortunate in being able to have worked both in central office and in the prisons, because most people usually work in one environment or the other. And I've worked in both. So I have a really broad perspective of how corrections operates, especially on the internal level, you know, and being able to work in central office and then the prison, because there's a divide between central office and prisons. Prison staff tend to not trust people who work in central office, because even though they're the policymakers, there is a broken down communication system in place. Central office will create a policy and shoot it out there as a one size fit all. And oftentimes it fails, because you have now about 41, 42 prisons. We were at a high of 70-something prisons at one point. But each prison, even though you operate under the same mission, the same exec team and all, they still have their own little nuances. So they still operate differently in some respects, right? So you can't shoot a one-size-fit-all policy out there. But they often do. And staff who have to enforce this policy are often not asked for their opinion, that the information is not shared until it's a done deal. And it causes chaos, right? So me knowing that when I left central office the last time and went back to the prison, I was able to kind of bridge, form a bridge in the prisons that I worked in because I understood, but I also now was one of them. You know, I walked in there as one of them, meaning one of those central office people that you don't trust, but I earned their trust and their respect to the point where they would come to me and believe me when I tried to explain why this was in place and to try and help them figure out, so how do we implement it here? And that put me in a unique position because as much as there's a divide between central office and prison, prison staff, there's a divide. And it's better now, but there's still a divide between civilian staff and security staff. And I was able to gain the trust of our security staff, which is crucial when you work in a prison. And to the point where we were able to implement these things with less chaos, which made life easier for the population because now you had staff who were less frustrated. Even though they may be doing something that they didn't like to do, they understood why they had to do it and they were better at doing it than if we had not had those conversations and those relationships. So that also rose down to the volunteers that came in to offer services, whether they were like parenting programs or counseling groups or whatever. You know, we were able to have better relationships, which I think gave a better product in the end, which made a better quality of life for the people who were incarcerated.
You know, one of the great things about working inside the facility and at different security levels, because there's a major difference between a minimum security and a supermax, you know, this is that you also see the outside people coming in, like visits. You know, you must have had opportunities where you saw families coming in during visits, and you get to see it from a different perspective, even though you're there doing your job, you know. So the area that you covered was so great. The knowledge that you have to bring to the table today is amazing. And I really think that what you're doing is really, really needed. People need to be educated, and the discussions have to happen about programs and policies. You must have seen some real change over the years that you did work within the system.
I saw a lot of changes in every area. And I had more control once I started to climb up the ladder and get the positions with some level of authority as far as the assistant director position and the director position, because I was able to create some things that I knew I felt would make a difference in people's lives. And not just for the incarcerated population, I was able to create some staff trainings. I was able to do some professional development. And, you know, people talk about, the media tend to put out a certain image of corrections. And I'm not saying that it's all right, true, but it's not, I'm not saying it's all wrong, but it's not all true. A lot of it is not true. People who don't work in the environment have a very warped sense of what goes on. But even now, if I meet somebody in the community and they say, what do you do? I say, well, I used to work in corrections. Most of the time, the next question is, oh, you were a guard? Well, first of all, that's not the right term, but that's not the only position that is in corrections. And I have to say, no, I came up through program services and I did this, this, this. And they're amazed to find out that a person can come into our system not knowing how to read and they can leave with a college degree. You know, as far as family services go, New York State is probably, at least the last time I looked, was the only state that offered a real family reunion program. And in that, for New York, that's about 3 days where certain family members can come into the prison in a separate area. They have little trailers set up, TVs, video games, kitchen. They can cook. The family brings in food. They cook. They have family time. They have bonding time with your kids or whomever for those 3 days. Versus what I saw in other states, I'm sorry. I thought I put that on mute. What I saw in other states, they gave, when they called a family reunion, a husband and a wife were given a cot for a few hours. That's not family reunion. So I have to commend New York for that. I have to commend New York for the stance that they take on education, because without education, a person is doomed to come back into the system, I believe. I think I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
That's okay, because the education piece is huge. I'm constantly saying, you know, whatever you can learn while you're there, take advantage of it. If no matter what it is, the opportunity to learn. Now I'm going to jump gears totally here, because I like to ask everybody that is a guest if they have an inspiring book, a book that changed their lives, an author, or just a favorite fiction book.
Well, so I'm going to have to, can I give you two answers?
Yes.
Okay. So this is me, Cheryl Morris. I was raised by a single mom from the South, who migrated north. But my mom and her mother picked cotton. And my mom grew up, you know, in a time when she wasn't, and nor my grandparents, they weren't seen really as equal. And they had to work hard. And my mom came up north to have a better life and to have a family and all of that. So the things that the stories I heard growing up just made me sick on how they were treated. My mom as a kid couldn't even go into a shoe store to get size for shoes. They had to draw an outline of the foot and try and match the shoe in the store. And if it fit, it fit, but you couldn't return it. So that's where I come from. And for me to be able to have a master's degree and to hold a position in a still racist and male dominated organization, which corrections is, but law enforcement as a whole, and to be able to have a voice to speak for people who didn't have a voice and wouldn't have an opportunity to come to those tables. And I'm not talking about just the incarcerated population. I'm talking about women. I'm talking about people of color, because oftentimes I was the only female and definitely the only person that was brown naturally in those rooms. And it's very intimidating. They try that. They employ these tactics on purpose to keep you quiet. They don't want you there, and it's known they don't want you there. But when they're forced to allow you to sit at the table, then they want you to be seen and not heard. So no matter how intimidating the situation was, I stayed focused on the fact of where I came from and where I am and what my mother and her mother and the people before them had to sacrifice to give me just an opportunity to sit at that table or to sit at that desk. To me, it was disrespectful to them to not say something when something was wrong. So I did. And I paid the price, because you don't challenge the system, you know, but in their eyes. But for me, my higher power is more important than our leadership. Because at the end of the day, I did what I thought was right. I treated people the way I wanted to be treated, and I was able to look myself in the mirror. So when we talk about inspiration, I have to go to Martin Luther King, right? I was born toward the end of the civil rights movement, but it's always been a favorite part of history for me. Although some governors say Black history is not history. But so Martin Luther King, for one. And when we talk about fictional, I'm going to tell you, they just came out with their 20th anniversary, I believe. But I loved The Color Purple, the original version. I read that book so many times. And at the time, there was VHS tapes versus all this other technology. And I watched my tape until it popped. It was I brought it to college with me. But just the experience that those things happen to people. So to know where we came from and see where we are, with even all the unfairness today, we've still come a long way. And we did that because some of us knew the challenges before us, and we knew what the consequences were if we spoke out, but we knew the cause was still more important than whatever pain and retaliation was coming our way. And we took those chances because it wasn't just about us. There was a bigger cause. So the sacrifices had to be made.
And there were huge sacrifices made throughout history. And, you know, people look at it and they say, oh, well, that was so long ago. No, it wasn't. I mean, I was born, well, I'm old. But my first trip to Miami, they had not taken down all the signs for the black and white bathrooms. And as a little child, I knew that was wrong. I knew it. You know, so those are things that it is, this is recent. This is not past history. This is recent history that affected, if it didn't affect us directly, it certainly affected mothers, grandmas, and family members.
And but you know what? It does. I'm sorry to cut you off, but it does affect everyone, because my grandmother, she never made it out of grade school. My mom graduated high school, but my grandmother was one of the smartest people. I learned more from her just sitting and listening to her life. I found my history, but my life, I learned so much more from her than I did in many of the college books that I read. And to say, for some people who say, oh, but that was so long ago, it may have been in some respect, but the trauma was never addressed, and it has been repeated throughout generations. So it makes it still new and fresh. Even if it happened 70 years, 150 years ago, the trauma piece is still there. And that's why prisons now are starting to introduce trauma-informed programs for people who dealt with whatever they had to deal with before they came in. Now you add those experiences on top of the black experience or the Jewish experience, you know, or whatever group you're dealing with, it's still fresh. It hasn't been dealt with properly. That's why our governor now is looking at reparation. Now, how that'll end up, I don't know. I don't know. But there's a committee now formed to look at how do you do that if you can.
That was done here in the state of Maine with the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, with the tribes that are here. And I think they did a pretty good job at it. I mean, I guess the best that they could. I mean, how do you repair the damage done?
Right.
You know, there's no real way of healing that, but talking about it, acknowledging that it happened. You know, when you get these people that say, oh, that didn't happen. Come on, you know, it just, we won't go there.
That's another conversation, right?
Yeah. So is there any last words that you have for our listeners today? Something that maybe we didn't cover?
I don't know. I think we touched on pretty much everything that I was hoping to touch on. But what I will say is I want to challenge anybody who's listening, who see things that are not right, especially in the reform space. You see it, but you don't say anything about it. You don't say anything. And you know what? I mean, let me go back and say, not just in the reform space. It can be life in general, because people are mistreated in every walk of life. It doesn't have to be because you're incarcerated. It doesn't have to be because you're a woman. It doesn't have to be because you're a person of color, or you're a migrant or whatever. You see something wrong, but you feel like it doesn't personally affect you, even though you don't agree with it. So you don't say anything for fear of isolation or retaliation. Just remember what we heard growing up. If you don't say anything, then you're just as guilty as the perpetrator. You know, if you have a voice, use that voice to make sure we push systems to do the right thing, because that may whatever you see that's wrong may not personally affect you today, but there has been something and there will be something that personally affects you in a negative way. And you're going to want somebody to help you. You're going to want somebody to help advocate, whether it's you personally or someone you love. So speak up, come out of your comfort zone, do the right thing. And, you know, people, these organizations, these cultures, they depend on people not saying anything. That's why they stay strong. That's why they continue to have the power and continue to mistreat people. So if you want to right those wrongs, you have to come out of your comfort zone and stand up for what's right.
That's perfect. I love that. Do the right thing. And that is the truth of it, too. If we don't speak up, we're part of the problem. So I want to remind everyone that we've had Cheryl Morris joining us today on the website. All of her contact info will be on there with the website and a little blip about her. She's been a great guest. Thank you so much, Cheryl, for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity, Valerie.
And the Prison Pod will be back again in a couple of weeks. Thank you, everyone.
Take care.
You have been listening to The Prison Pod, a podcast not just for those in prison, but for anyone who has been affected by incarceration. Ms. Valerie would love for you to write to her with your questions, comments, and show ideas. The address is Prison Pod, Post Office Box 294, Orono, Maine, 04473. Remember, reading opens doors, so pick up that book.